recently I saw a poll that was written up in the newspaper about institutions that have an influence on our culture. Maybe you also had the opportunity to read about that, where it talked about the shaping of our culture that comes as a result of the influence, for example, from the White House, or from the Supreme Court justices, or state government, or the media, the entertainment world, and so on. And as they listed, in descending order, the institutions of most influence in our culture, I was saddened to see that at the very bottom of the list was the Christian Church. And I began to think about that, and I think you're aware of the fact that there are many people who are indifferent toward the Christian Church today. And in addition to the indifference, there are quite a lot of folks out there who are outwardly hostile toward the church, toward religious people. Well, Billy Graham, for example, every year he appears in the top five most admired and respected Americans, but also his name will crop up from time to time in those lists that are equally directed towards those who are unpopular. So we find this sense of ambivalence and at times hostility towards the church in general and to Christians in particular. But the thing that strikes me as I think about this is that as many people as there are out there who are opposed to the church or turned off to Christians, it is rare indeed to find somebody who will speak ill of Jesus. Even if people are not Christians and they're not believers, they will say, well, yes, I respect Jesus, I admire Jesus, he was the greatest teacher that ever lived, or yes, he was a prophet. You've heard that sort of acknowledgement of the unparalleled greatness of Jesus of Nazareth. In fact, the applause for Jesus is so warm and friendly. Sometimes I scratch my head and say, well, if he was such a wonderful person, why was he killed? If you've ever been to Jerusalem and you go down that winding road that comes by, I think it's the Eastern Wall, down near the pinnacle of the temple, you will see an ancient building, a little edifice there, with that's called the Tomb of the Prophets. And they have the figures, I think, of Jeremiah and a couple of the other prophets there, carved into the stone. And it's a tourist attraction. And people come there and they talk about this tremendous heritage and tradition that the Jewish nation has for giving the world the wisdom from these prophets. But what happened to those prophets when they were alive? They were killed, they were beaten, they were persecuted, they were despised, just as Jesus was beaten, despised, ridiculed, and ultimately killed. How do we account for that? Why would Jesus of Nazareth, the best man that ever lived, be so ruthlessly eliminated by his contemporaries? I think that the answer to that question as to why Jesus was killed lies deep within our hearts as human beings and the responses that we've already examined that we have toward that which is holy. You remember that the group of people who were most infuriated by Jesus were the Pharisees. They were the ones that hated him. They were the ones that conspired together to plot his death. Well, who were the Pharisees? And why were they called Pharisees? There weren't any Pharisees in the Old Testament. The whole party of the Pharisees emerged in the intertestamental period, a time when the religious life of Israel was on the decline. After the captivity, people began to become secularized and to forget the traditions and to forget the law of Moses and of the fathers. And so a group of men banded together and made a commitment. We are going to devote ourselves, they said, to righteousness and to the law. And we're going to separate ourselves from secularism. And those people called themselves the separated ones. And the word that was used to describe that was the word Pharisee. And so their beginnings were noble. They were covered with virtue. They were zealous in their pursuit of righteousness. And after a couple of hundred years, they had achieved quite a reputation. they were considered by their contemporaries in Israel to be the most righteous, the most pure, the most godly of all people. But something happened. The Holy One of Israel came to town. And the righteous fellows in town were the ones who killed him. Why? A few years ago, a book reached the top of the bestseller list in this country and has since become an integral part of the business lore of American industry, a book entitled The Peter Principle. Remember that? Where a fellow was examining how people move to and fro and up and down in the corporate structures of American business enterprises. And of course, the Peter Principle, which has since become axiomatic to our understanding of business, is the law that people tend to rise to their level of incompetency in business. That is, if they show skills and performance at the very low levels of the company or the enterprise, they're quickly promoted, and then if they do a good job, they're promoted, and they keep going up the ladder until what? Until they either reach the top, or they reach a point that is one step beyond where they were successful. And this is one of the reasons why we have so many people frozen into positions who are miserable in their businesses. But of course, we know all about that Peter Principle. But in addition to an examination of that strange phenomenon in business, the author of the book examined a couple of other dimensions. He said, who doesn't end up in that level of incompetence? He said, there are two kinds of people. There is, first of all, the super incompetent. The super incompetent never rises to his level of incompetency because he doesn't have to rise to be incompetent. He's incompetent from the start. He's weeded out of the organization very quickly because there's no level in the organization at which he's proficient. There's no level at which he's competent. He can't do anything. And so he doesn't get caught in the Peter Principle. And there's another person, he said, who doesn't get caught in the Peter Principle. He is the super competent. Now, the book may be a bit cynical, but he said the super competent also has great difficulty rising in the organization. And he said, as a general rule, if the super competent is going to make it, he has to move from company to company. Because the super competent fellow threatens who? His boss, whoever is above him. And so he gets all kind of grief, and he is frozen below the level of his competence because he represents a threat. And so if he's going to be successful, he has to move into another area or into another company where he's not known and where he's not going to be threatening to those around him. Have you noticed in this world that we don't like perfect people? I know when I make some kind of gaffe or if I do something that's obviously outrageous, you know, people will say to me, oh, I'm so glad you're human. And I want to laugh. I said, what do you think I am? I mean, was there ever any doubt about my humanity? But why do people seem to give this sigh of relief when they find out that I'm human? What they're doing is to say, I'm so glad to know that you sin. You're rejoicing in my downfall? You're rejoicing in my sin? Why? Did you really entertain any idea that I may not be sinful? Whatever make anybody think that of me is beyond me, except that I'm a minister. I'm a clergyman. I go out on the golf course. I'm playing golf with guys having a good time, and they miss the ball, and they utter an expletive. They fail to delete it. And then we get to the sixth hole, and they say, what do you do? And they find out I'm a minister. And then right away, I get all these profuse apologies for their language, as if I've never heard these words before. And as if they're accountable to me for what's coming out of their mouth. They're not accountable to me. I live in this world. I'm part of this world. I'm as fallen as they are. But they suddenly become less than sociable. Suddenly a distance comes. As soon as they know I'm a minister, they don't want to get too friendly. They're uncomfortable. Why? Because of what I represent. While I'm talking about golf, I might as well tell another story of a man who's on the professional golf tour. He recognizes his name, so I won't mention it. But a few years ago, there was a major golf tournament, and before this tournament, they had a celebrity pro-am event, and this golfer was teamed up in a foursome that included Jack Nicklaus, then President Ford, Gerald Ford, and Billy Graham. And they went out on the golf course in this foursome, Billy Graham, the President of the United States, Jack Nicklaus, and this other man. And they played 18 holes of golf, and when they came in off the golf course, another friend of mine happened to be there, and he went up to this fellow and he said, "What was it like playing golf with Billy Graham?" And the professional golfer exploded in a tirade, a paroxysm of fury. He said, "I don't need to have Billy Graham shoving religion down my throat." And he stormed away and went towards the practice tee. Well, my friend, you know, didn't know quite how to handle this explosion, so he sort of timidly walked over behind him and sat down in a chair at the practice range and watched the man hit golf balls. And he just started pounding out shot after shot. Finally, when he was done, he turned around and my friend said to him, "Did Billy really come on strong?" And he said, "No," he said, "as a matter of fact, Billy didn't say anything to me about religion. I just had a bad round of golf." What's that tell you? This man exploded and charged Billy Graham with trying to shove religion down his throat. Billy Graham didn't say a word about religion through 18 holes of golf on the golf. And yet the man came away feeling crowded. He felt oppressed. He felt like Billy Graham was out to get him. Why? Because Billy Graham's name is so associated with the things of God that Billy Graham doesn't have to say a thing about Christ. He doesn't have to say a thing about... All he has to do is show up with a golf club in his hand and people are saying, "You're shoving religion down my throat." If you are a Christian, that's what you represent to the world. And they feel pushed, crowded, uncomfortable. We don't like to be exposed. We give examinations in the classroom and the kids are screaming after the test, "Oh, that wasn't fair, it was too hard," and I look at the grades and I'm getting all these 50s and 40s and 30s and 60s. I had this happen to me this year at the seminary. A worst performance a class ever had on one of my tests, and there was a girl, and she happened to be from Pittsburgh, thank God. She made 100%. And I said, "This girl made 100%. Now, what do you suppose the audience did? The class did. Do you think that they turned around and stood up and gave her a standing ovation? They groaned, they hissed, they hooted. Boo! Didn't like that. She broke the curve. Who broke the curve for the Pharisees? These ones who played at being holy, who played at being righteous, were very comfortable until pure, authentic righteousness showed up. All Jesus had to do was to walk in the room and the Pharisees were furious because their facade of righteousness was broken. When the true Holy One came, all of the phony approximations of holiness were exposed instantly, and they couldn't stand it. They had to get rid of him. But it wasn't just the Pharisees that responded like that to Jesus. His own disciples, more than once, became very, very uncomfortable with him. I want to go to the scriptures again, to a passage that I'm sure you're familiar with in Mark's gospel, that's found in the fourth chapter, beginning at verse 35. This is after Jesus had preached and spoken parables to his disciples. He wanted to get away from the multitudes. He wanted to withdraw for a moment from the crowds. And so it said, he privately explained to his own disciples all these things about the parables. And then it says, "On that day, when evening had come, he said to them, 'Let us go across to the other side.'" They're on the shores of the lake or the Sea of Galilee. And he wants them to get in the boat and go across the lake. "And leaving the crowd, they took him with them, just as he was, in the boat, and there were other boats with him. And a great storm of wind arose." Again, I ask you if you've ever been to Palestine, if you've ever been into the Galilee, and you've seen the Sea of Galilee, which is a huge, big lake, and it sort of sits at the bottom of a saucer. It's surrounded by mountains, and there's a strange phenomenon of nature there with the desert on one extreme and the Mediterranean Ocean on the other extreme, and these sudden storms will come up and sort of come down through the mountains that serve as a wind funnel and just blow into the Sea of Galilee without any warning. There are no signs that one can interpret that one of these sudden, violent storms is going to erupt. And when it does, this peaceful, tranquil lake is turned into a churning, violent, tempestuous body of water. In fact, to this day, when we went out there in a modernized vessel to go across, we were told that there are some people that still won't go out on that lake. And we were warned of what could happen to us today if we encountered engine trouble. And in fact, we did. We got out in the middle of the Sea of Galilee and the engines quit. And we're sitting there becalmed in the middle. And I'm saying, oh God, don't give me an existential experience of a storm on the Sea of Galilee. I'll just believe what I read. I don't need to experience. But it was that kind of a storm that came up on the sea. Now remember, Jesus is in a boat with his friends who are professional veteran fishermen. And this tempest comes with great violence, and the scriptures tell us that they became afraid. Do you hear that, Mr. Freud, Dr. Freud? You understand now we have a story here where people are afraid of nature. The storm has them frightened. Keep that in mind, Dr. Freud. I don't want you to forget. All right, he's now, the disciples are afraid, and what's Jesus doing? He's taking a nap. He's back placidly resting in the rear of the boat, sound asleep. And we read here in the text, a great storm of wind arose, the waves beat into the boat so that the boat was already filling, but he, that is Jesus, was in the stern, asleep on the cushions. And they woke him and said to him, "Do you not care if we perish?" I don't know what they expected Jesus to do. But what do men do when they're suddenly in a crisis and they're in trouble and death is threatening them? If they don't know what to do, they look to their leader. They look to their leader, he's taking a nap. I don't know how, have you ever seen people, I don't know there are people like that. I've seen them on airplanes. I got on an airplane once with Jim Boyce, California. We take off in this terrible turbulence. I can't stand to be in airplanes on a smooth day. Well, we were in this storm, and it's buffeting us back and forth, and I'm sitting there holding on far more, so I'm saying silent prayers, my knuckles are white, and Jim Boyce is saying, "Isn't this exhilarating? Isn't this," he thought he was at Coney Island or something on one of these amusements, he just loved it. And then I've been on it where stewardesses are screaming and lightning is flashing outside the windows, and the guy next to me, sound asleep. I want to wring his neck. I says, "Is there something wrong with you? You know? Don't you have a good sense to be terrified like I am?" Huh? Jesus is like one of these guys. He is sound asleep in the back of the boat. And so they get over him. They say, "Will you wake up? Do something!" So what does he do? You know what he does. He gets up, wipes the sleepers from his eyes, stretches. You know, the boat's rocking all over the place and these guys are holding on. Jesus looks at the storm. He sees the wind blowing and the waves 50 feet high. And he starts to talk to the water. He doesn't just talk. He raises his voice. He screams at them. He looks out at the sea and he says, "Peace! Be still!" And like that, the wind ceases. There's not even a zephyr rippling the water. Absolutely calm, like glass. No wind. No waves. The Lord of nature uttered a command, and nature obeyed without hesitation. Now the question I want to ask you is this. Now, how did the disciples react? What do you expect? To throw their sou'westers up in the air and their hats on the oars and they start dancing around in the boat almost capsizing and saying, "That was the most incredible thing you've ever done, Jesus. We knew you could do it. We really weren't scared. We knew all we had to do was wake you up, and as soon as we shook you from your dogmatic slumbers, that you would do that," and that'd be... Is that what it says? The Bible said, now they became very much afraid. Dr. Freud, remember I told you to hang on over there. Dr. Freud. Do you see, the men were in fact terrified by nature, but when the Lord of nature came and removed the terror of nature, these men had an intensity of fear. It wasn't diminished. It was augmented. Now they're more scared than they were when the storm was raging. Why? They asked a question. They asked a very significant question, a very important question, a question we dare not skate over lightly and miss in our reading of sacred scripture. They ask this question. They say, what manner of man is this? That even the winds and the storms obey him. What kind of a guy is this? I like to read polls. I talk about the polls that I read. Talk about the fears that American people have. Phobias. We're a phobic people. People are scared of the dark. They're scared of high places. They're scared of crowded places. Claustrophobia, agoraphobia, and all this. Aquaphobia. Scared of water. You know what the number one fear is? Standing in front of a group. That's the number one phobia in the United States. The head of death. The stranger. A fear of the alien. Sociologists will tell us that one of the reasons why they don't understand their customs, they don't understand their behavioral patterns, they don't understand their own traditions. In order to overcome those fears, anytime we meet somebody new for the first time, we pigeonhole you and you and you comfortably into a human category with which we're familiar, then I know how to deal with you. Magnitude. They couldn't find a category. Ended everything that was normal and ordinary that they were familiar with, because what they saw on the sea, boats are empty, they're mad, they're irritated, they're frustrated, spent the whole night out there for nothing. Jesus sees them coming, he says, he doesn't say this, we'll humor him. Humor the master. Throw the net. He's excited. He rushes over to Jesus, pulls a contract out of his paper, and he said, just sign on the bottom line, Jesus, and said, depart from me. I feel dirty. Your holiness, pressured by the presence of the Holy One of Israel, that they screamed. Are you afraid to get close to him? Are you afraid that you are sinful? The world wants space and room.